Welcome to Sound Practice, the business podcast for physicians and healthcare leaders, hosted by Mike Tsakopoulos and produced by the American Association for Physician Leadership.
In recent years, the healthcare community has struggled as politics invaded certain medical issues. One such issue is gun violence. My guest today is uniquely qualified to discuss the individual and public health consequences of gun violence in the United States, the facts and solutions to gun violence and medicine in our country, next on Sound Practice. My guest today is Megan Rainey. Dr. Rainey is a professor of emergency medicine at Yale School of Medicine. Dr. Rainey is also dean of the Yale School of Public Health. She's a nationally known expert on gun violence. Dr. Rainey has been elected to the National Academy of Medicine. Megan Rainey, welcome to Sound Practice.
Thank you. It's a joy to join you today.
Well, it's an absolute pleasure to speak with you. Thank you for your time. You're an emergency medicine physician and public health researcher, and you've recently become dean of the Yale School of Public Health. Can you share a bit about your career journey? What brought you to medicine, to public health, and to your current position as a dean?
Thank you. It's been a bit of a winding journey, right? It's one of those things, as I'm sure you hear often, where when you look back, you can make a linear story out of it, but along the way, it was full of twists and turns. I made my way into medicine by being a Peace Corps volunteer. I thought that I was going to go and work overseas in foreign aid or journalism. Spent 2.5 years in West Africa at the height of the HIV/AIDS epidemic, and realized that I really wanted to be able to treat patients as well as to describe and act on systemic problems. Went from there to med school, fell in love with emergency medicine, which I will unabashedly say is an incredible specialty within the House of Medicine. It's team-based, it's the safety net of the American healthcare system, and it really is the canary in the coal mine for every public health problem out there. It's a really tremendous space, and the people that dedicate their careers to working in the emergency department, whether as doctors, nurses, social workers, are just some of the most incredible practitioners out there. So loved my emergency medicine training, and while in emergency medicine, went almost the opposite way from where I'd gone in Peace Corps, where the structural problems became so apparent to me. I very quickly got frustrated with taking care of patients with utterly preventable problems, and equally frustrated with sending people back out onto the streets or to the their homes, knowing that they were walking back into the same situations that had landed them in the emergency department in the first place. And that's what then had me go and do public health training. I've spent the last 20 years, both as a clinician and as a public health researcher and advocate and activist, and found my way into being dean almost by accident. Really, my North Star, my driving force in my career, has been looking for the way to make the most difference on the health of other humans, whether on an individual level when I'm working as a doctor or on a population level through that public health work. And right now, at this moment, being dean, especially at the Yale School of Public Health, is really just an incredible opportunity to think about how we improve the health of populations and how I improve the work and the success of my colleagues in clinical medicine. If you talk to any physician or nurse right now, you're going to hear about the frustrations with the fact that we are, you know, the fingers in the dike holding up society, and that so much of our time as clinicians is spent dealing with social problems and with inadequate resources to address them. By being a dean of a school of public health and creating science and systems level change, I can hopefully, of course, improve the health of populations, but also make my fellow clinicians' job a little bit easier and more fulfilling.
One of those issues that you must have seen and grappled with in the ER is gun violence. And you're, as I mentioned, a national expert on this problem. Gun violence is a public health problem. Can you tell us what you mean by this and what exactly is a public health approach to this issue?
Yeah, well, gosh, you and I are talking right after the latest tragedy in Georgia, that the shooting at the high school in Appalachia, which, like most school shootings, was utterly, utterly preventable. I think I, like anyone else in the House of Medicine, has taken care of countless victims of gun violence, generally victims of community violence, right? We know that Friday and Saturday nights are going to be the quote-unquote knife and gun club in emergency medicine. We choose our residencies in part based off of the volume of penetrating trauma that we'll care for as residents, knowing that we need that training for when we go out into an attending job. And just as I told you, my journey into public health and wanting to approach structural problems that brought people to my door, similarly, same journey specifically for gun violence, where, you know, at one point in early in my time as an attending, had this realization that the violence that was bringing people to my door was just as preventable as the heart disease or the suicidal ideation or any of the other things that come to the emergency department for care. You know, at that point, and going back again almost 20 years now, people didn't really talk about violence as a public health problem. And I was in fact told by mentors to stay away from the issue, that it was a third rail for academic medicine, for public health. It was not a career path that would lead to funding, but I was not willing to accept the patients coming through my door as something that was a foregone conclusion. And so started to create coalitions with other physicians, nurses, of course, public health researchers, survivors, social workers, to try to create a path forward. And really that path forward, when I say applying a public health approach to the problem of gun violence, it's quite simple. The public health approach is four standard steps that we apply to a myriad health problems. First, you define the scope of the problem. How common is it? Second, you examine risk and protective factors. What puts someone more at risk? What protects them? All other things being equal. Then you design interventions that would make a difference. And when you figure out what works, you scale it up. That's the approach that we take, again, for heart disease. It's the approach that we took to COVID. And we can apply it to injuries as well. We've decreased car crash deaths by over 70% over the last few decades by applying that standard public health approach. And we've been successful in some countries in reducing suicide deaths by applying the public health approach, not here in the U.S. And unfortunately, we've not been successful in reducing suicide deaths in the U.S., largely because we haven't talked about the problem of guns. Two-thirds of gun deaths in this country are gun suicides. And so that's just as much of a part of the discussion about gun deaths as gun violence or these school shootings. So anyhow, public health approach, started advocating for it and have slowly but surely over the last 20 years succeeded in creating coalitions of researchers, getting federal funding reinstated in 2020 for the first time in 24 years. We've created a research society for the prevention of firearm-related harms, and are slowly but surely creating evidence to inform what we do, and also are creating coalitions, because when you approach this as a health problem, yes, of course, it's political. All of medicine, all of public health is political, but it takes away some of the us versus them rhetoric, and instead we can operate based off of actual data about what's most likely to work and create partnerships and coalitions to put that in place. So there have been some really terrific successes over the past few years. Unfortunately, they're not coming fast enough for the 40,000 people that lost their lives last year, or for those kids in Georgia, kids and teachers in Georgia just a couple days ago.
We're, as you mentioned, talking at the time of the latest school shooting, and I think that the average American probably views that as the manifestation of the problem of gun violence and not the two out of three gun deaths by suicide. Isn't the first challenge defining the problem?
Yeah, absolutely, right? That is that first step in the public health approach. And defining the problem, getting agreement on what the problem is foundational. And it's, again, that's the beauty of taking a public health approach instead of a criminal justice approach, is that we're not waiting until someone needs to enter the criminal justice system. Instead, we're describing both the patterns of death, but also the patterns of injury and the patterns of health harm for folks who may not ever be touched by a bullet. You know, there was a recent survey by Kaiser Family Foundation reporting that 54% of American adults say that either they or someone in their immediate family has been present at a shooting or has been shot. It's an astounding statistic. And there's a margin of error. So say it's 20% less than KFF estimates.
Oh, even if it's by an order of magnitude, it's still an enormous number,
it's
right?
An enormous number. And I think part of it is because so many of us don't think about the fact that gun suicide counts, gun domestic violence counts, having a shooting next to your school counts, right? And most of those are not these horrific mass school shootings that strike terror in the heart of parents, right? Most of these are these everyday events that barely get reported in the news, but that our friends and our families live with the consequences of forever. There are studies showing that school kids do worse on tests after a school shooting in their neighborhood, even if they didn't know the person that was shot. Just knowing that there was a shooting kind of immediately in their neighborhood, they then do worse. Kids in Philadelphia are more likely to come to the emergency department with an acute mental illness complaint if they were within a quarter, if they live within a quarter mile of where a shooting took place. So there's all these studies talking about this real health ripple effect of gun violence. And if we can focus on decreasing that, it then gives us some paths forward that may not be possible when we turn it into this, you know, us versus them, gun owners versus non-gun owners. At the end of the day, nobody, whether you're a gun owner or a non-gun owner, wants themselves or a family member to be exposed to this kind of harm.
Absolutely. And so those were really interesting studies and statistics. It seems to me that part of your position is translating that into concrete steps that can be taken to bridge the gap between research and science and actual public policy. On a systems level or an individual level, can you give me some concrete plans? I'm struggling. Absolutely. I want something to hold on to here.
I know, right? We all want hope right now. And I think, honestly, if there's nothing else that people take out of this podcast, it would be that there is hope and that becoming numb is not actually the answer. So here are some really concrete things that we can do as individuals. You mentioned policy, and policy absolutely matters. And there's a lot of great policies out there, things like red flag laws, things like safe storage laws make a huge difference. But there's a lever below policy that matters just as much. So there's lots of studies showing that safe storage laws correlate with decreased number of child shootings of kids, either unintentional suicide or school shootings. Well, there's a really simple thing that people can and should do, whether or not there's a law in their state, which is make sure if they have a gun in their home, that it is locked up and inaccessible to those who are not trained users. And if you have family members who are firearm owners, same discussion, make sure that that firearm is locked in a safe or with a trigger lock or with a cable lock, right? It's not enough to put it up on a shelf or underneath the seat of your car or in your nightstand, but to make sure it truly is stored safely. That's the first thing that can be done. A second big thing that we can all do is to be aware of risk factors. Again, talking about this tragedy in Georgia, there were plenty of red flags and risk factors. And although the solution for gun violence, it is not all about mental health treatment, awareness of what those risk factors are, whether it's suicidal thoughts, and P.S., every clinician, when you take care of a patient who mentions suicidal thoughts, you should ask that patient if they own or have access to a gun, right? So know that risk factor and be able to counsel them on safe storage or getting the gun out of the house. Same thing for domestic violence, same thing for dementia, right? Lots of folks with dementia, we talk to them about not driving. Do we ask them about whether or not there's a gun in the home and making sure that that's stored safely? So knowing the risk factors for gun violence, and again, being able to counsel folks on either getting rid of a gun temporarily or making sure it's stored up safely is another step. And then a third step takes us even further out of the clinical realm. A third thing that we can do is to be involved in community mentorship. One of the best protections from community violence is actually having a caring adult or a parental figure. And programs like Big Brothers, Big Sisters, Boys and Girls Club, 4-H have all been shown to be protective. And so our volunteering time in our communities to mentor or be involved can make a big difference. Last thing, if we're going really kind of big picture, is talking about the environment in which we live. Streetlights, gardens being put into vacant lots, those all make a difference in the rate of gun violence as well. And so there are things that you can do in your, if you live in an urban area around beautification, and that really improves safety and well-being in a general way, but also have a real impact on the likelihood of gun violence in your community. Yes, all of those have data behind them. They're all evidence-based. And you'll note that most of them didn't actually have to do with passing laws.
Very nice. That was a hopeful answer. Thank you. Makes me feel better already.
Now we just got to do it.
Amen to that. Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that historically, public health has been siloed in relation to health care. You're obviously a leader in both fields. Do you see big challenges here for integration?
It's a great question. I think it's one of the fundamental challenges facing our country. We're seeing dramatic decreases in life expectancy, even post the worst of the COVID pandemic. And that is largely lack of attention to kind of that underpinning of health on a societal basis. And we, those of us in healthcare, are being asked to pick up the pieces of a non-functional health infrastructure. If you go back 100 plus years, public health and healthcare were much more structurally integrated. And I think going forwards, it's on both sides to work more closely together. I'm fortunate I and our School of Public Health at Yale are part of a new coalition called the Common Health Coalition that was founded by Dave Chokshi, who was former commissioner of health in New York City. It's brought together a lot of big healthcare organizations, including the American Hospital Association, AHIP, Trust for America's Health, as well as some large public health organizations, including the American Public Health Association and others, trying to do exactly this, to think about how do we bring the two sides, the individual and the population level, together to address these underlying barriers that are making people sick or keeping them from getting healthy. I think it behooves us to spend more time and attention on that, to share data, to share resources, to advocate together for investments in the community that can make the folks that we take care of healthier. If we don't, I think we're going to keep seeing worse life expectancy, higher healthcare expenses, and more burnout in the healthcare and public health workforce.
As you know, this is the podcast of the American Association for Physician Leaders. So we have a number of physician leaders listening to us. What tips do you have for physician leaders who are interested in joining you and in helping in this cause?
Well, I always advocate for getting trained in public health. Certainly, whether through a short course or a formal master's in public health, a foundational understanding of really, it's more than kind of population health and thinking about insurance schemes or ACOs. There's really some really fundamental but not difficult techniques that we use to look at patterns and analyze them and use them to improve population or community-wide health. I think partnerships with your local health department are always terrific. Most of us as hospitals that are nonprofit do our community health needs assessment, and that can be done in partnership with your local health department and community-based organizations. And then I'd say check out the community, the Common Health Coalition. And for those interested in working on gun violence, most of our specialty societies at this point actually have some great work going on. ABIM, ACS, American College of Emergency Physicians, AAP, all have strong work and resources. And so would encourage folks to look into those. And lastly, for those physician leaders who are in the C-suite, we actually have a CEO's Council working on gun violence that was put together through Northwell Health. I'm privileged to be part of that group as well. And they're really looking at what C-suite leaders can do to reduce the risk of gun violence in their community. So there's a lot of options out there and look forward to seeing more physician leaders get involved.
Great. Your trajectory as a woman leader in both healthcare, the public eye, academic leadership is, I would have to say, rather unusual. How do you pull all of this off for somebody who is out there thinking, can I do these type of things? How do you pull it off, and what are the challenges and opportunities that you've encountered over your career?
To my knowledge, I am the first emergency physician to be a dean of a school of public health. So it is a bit unusual. I'm quite proud to be in this role and to represent my fellow emergency physicians, but also, again, to work on behalf of all of us. I think there's a couple things. One is, I said this much earlier in the interview, but it really is about following one's North Star, what brought us into this field, into this profession, and looking for the space where you can have the greatest impact. I think that has been, you know, my driving decision maker throughout my career and has led me to this point. I do think that research and evidence creation matters deeply. That's true whether you're working on quality improvement, whether you're writing NIH grants, or whether you're working in partnership with a community-based organization or an insurance company, a payer. So thinking about how you can grow your skill set in evidence generation, in data collection and analysis, is really worthwhile. And then the third part, and my guess is everyone listening to this podcast would agree with this, is to grow a great team. You don't do anything alone ever. And gosh, this podcast, I've talked a lot about my own work, but really it's all been collective. It's been work that I've done in partnership with other physician leaders, other public health leaders, government officials, community leaders. And so the really very best tip or guidance that I can give is to find that team and nurture it, and nurture the folks within it, because that's ultimately what creates success.
Our time is coming to an end, but I'm interested to know if you can tell a difference in the students that are attending School of Public Health now than when you attended it. Do we have a good pipeline of creative people coming along? Again, I'm looking for some hope here, Doctor.
Well, at the Yale School of Public Health, we've seen an increasing number of applicants and an increasing selectivity in our admissions over the past few years. Certainly, there was a big bump in interest during the midst of COVID, but there remain a lot of really bright young minds and middle-aged and older minds that are interested in going deeper into this field. We have folks at the Yale School of Public Health who come from not only all over the world, but also from a wide variety of professional backgrounds. We have pharmacists, EMTs, lawyers, journalists, as well as physicians and nurses who are pursuing a degree with us and who are so driven to help create the foundational infrastructure for their communities to thrive physically, but also emotionally, socially, economically. So I'm quite enthused about the future. But again, it takes all of us to get there. And so I look forward to more folks that listen to this podcast joining us in that quest for improving the public's health.
Well, what a nice way to end. Thank you very much for being on Sound Practice, and thank you for your work, because really your success is enjoyed by all of us, and it's all of our success. So continued best wishes. My guest has been Dr. Megan Rainey, Dean of the Yale School of Public Health. Dr. Rainey, thank you so much.
Thank you.
My thanks to Megan Rainey for her time and insights. Dr. Rainey's thoughtful approach to the social and health problems of gun violence in this country makes her a true physician leader. My thanks also to the American Association for Physician Leadership for making this podcast possible. Please join me next time on Sound Practice. We release a new episode every other Wednesday.
You've been listening to Sound Practice, the business podcast for physicians and healthcare leaders. Check out the show notes for this episode at soundpracticepodcast.com. If you have any suggestions for future episodes, we'd love to hear them. Email us at info@soundpracticepodcast.com. Subscribe to Sound Practice wherever you listen to podcasts so you can automatically receive our episodes. And please rate us and comment on the podcast in iTunes and Google Play. Sound Practice is presented and produced by the team at American Association for Physician Leadership. We are the world's premier organization for all aspects of physician leadership in every sector of healthcare. Learn more at physicianleaders.org. That man Robin went to Kapow.